So right now we're going to read the demands out, and you're going to sit here and you're going to listen, because we have things we have to say and that problems that need to be fixed.
Coming up on Carolina Connection, UNC holds a town hall forum to start a dialogue on race, but protesters weren't interested in cooperation. Good morning, I'm Sarah Thomas.
And I'm Luis Fernandez. Also this morning, a UNC task force works to provide some context to controversial campus monuments. We take a trip down the Cape Fear River with a man who has dedicated his life to protecting it. A new campus tradition hopes to spotlight the real reason for Thanksgiving. And who knew? Carrboro is a singles paradise.
I was sitting kind of outside, and I remember seeing this girl was sitting and reading some kind of book, and this guy came and sat next to her and was talking to her about the book, and it just seemed like something out of a movie.
From the UNC School of Media and Journalism, this is Carolina Connection.
Thanks for joining us. At colleges nationwide, a discussion is underway about race. It started with the protests at Missouri that led to the chancellor's resignation, and it's spread to dozens of other schools, including UNC, where officials held a town hall event last Thursday night. Administrators encouraged the campus community to share ideas on how to make Carolina more inclusive. But from early on, things didn't go quite according to plan. We begin our coverage with Chandler Carpenter.
Chancellor Carol Folt opened the town hall with a reminder for everybody to be respectful.
Carolina can never reach its dream of being excellent until everyone here feels as welcome and respected as every other.
But then, she introduced the facilitator of the event, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Clarence Page.
Thank you, Chancellor Folt. Can everybody hear me? Good. I won't need this microphone then. One mic is enough for tonight. Thank you all.
A group of students interrupted Page even before he opened the floor to discussion. They read out 50 demands, including eliminating tuition, firing recently hired UNC system president Margaret Spellings, and taking down the Silent Sam Memorial.
So right now we're going to read the demands out, and you're going to sit here and you're going to listen, because we have things we have to say and that problems that need to be fixed.
The group spoke for about 20 minutes, much longer than the allotted 2 minutes per speaker. They left Memorial Hall chanting, but not before sophomore Sakila Trowers stood up and criticized their interruption.
There are people here that have taken their time to come here to listen to us.
Thank you.
You may speak for a lot of us, but at the same time, we need to come together and make a solution. We can spout demands all day. We can yell and scream that Black Lives Matter all day, but until we get together and make a solution, nothing is gonna change. And I need you all to understand. I need you to understand.
Things were more orderly after that. Speakers suggested things like cultural celebrations on campus and giving the Black student movement a permanent meeting place. After the meeting was over, I caught up with Trowers to see if she thought the town hall did what it set out to do.
It made a very appropriate culture for people to come and voice their opinions. And I think it was very solution-oriented, if that makes sense. I think people definitely just had the chance to come and voice opinions, and now we can really take steps to seeing what can be done to improve these race relations here on campus.
Sophomore Madrid K. Danner Smith also said the town hall meeting was a productive platform for discussion.
I think things happen for a reason, and everything that happened was supposed to happen. What else that needs to happen is there needs to be a follow-up.
Danner Smith gave a suggestion to university administration during the meeting. He said the university should contact the Racial Equity Institute, a Greensboro group that holds anti-racism workshops, to educate the campus community. Chancellor Folt noted his suggestion and many others.
I could go on about the various things we heard. I can't make any specific promises today except to say that we will continue. You know, our work will not be done. And yet, I believe we can make real progress that people can see.
Friday, Chancellor Folt said members of the senior leadership team will share steps to address these issues before the exam period begins in 2 weeks. In Chapel Hill, I'm Chandler Carpenter.
Many speakers at Thursday night's town hall address institutionalized racism, but many students say that in addition to overtly racist actions against them, they have experienced so-called microaggressions. But what does this term mean exactly? Jessica Coates has more.
By this point, Destiny Talley had had enough. When the sophomore finally got to the microphone during Thursday's town hall forum, she said she hadn't been planning to speak.
I was kind of like shaking a little bit because out of the most respect to you and faculty members, if you're making comments like you do, Mr. Page, and belittling people who are speaking, it is like you are listening, but you are not hearing us.
Her comment was directed toward the moderator of the event, Clarence Page, the prominent Black author and columnist. He said afterward,
judging by what a couple of students said, I emitted a couple of microaggressions. I only wish we had time so I could tell me what they were so I could try to avoid them next time.
The term microaggression was coined by Harvard professor Chester Pierce in 1970, but it has only extended into pop culture in the last decade. The word refers to small acts that are perceived by the recipient as intimidating or threatening to their personhood. Senior Kessia Hall, a Black student, has had several of these interactions, but one stood out in particular.
I got into a car accident and had a concussion. I went to my professor to have a conversation about finishing the semester, and he said to me, "You're not passing either way, so you might as well just withdraw from the course."
Hall went on to tell him that she didn't know what he was talking about. Just weeks before, she had received one of the highest grades on the last exam. Hall insisted on finishing the course and ended up with an A-. But the experience stuck with her.
The thing about microaggressions is that for him, I'm pretty sure he just went on with his jolly old day and just kept it moving. But for me, I sat with that for like months.
Donato Funsu, a professor in the UNC Department of African, African American, and Diaspora Studies, said that those interactions can cause more than just emotional pain. Accumulated microaggressions can lead to serious health problems, like high blood pressure and heart conditions.
If in a day you have been the target of 10 acts of aggression that way, and the next day 10 more by the weekend, you know, you would have been the target of many instances of those things.
Senior Kiera Campbell, another Black student, says that these acts can happen in many different ways, even just being in a mostly white class.
I feel like I have to be more prepared. I have to feel like that I have to prove that I'm worthy to be in this classroom.
Because microaggressions are often unintended slights, they can be difficult to identify and stop. But Professor Funsu echoes students' comments from Thursday night in suggesting a solution.
There should be classes that specifically address these issues. How many times we have heard jokes, racist jokes or sexist jokes, and we don't say anything, and we laugh about them, but not the person who is the target of the joke is hurting.
In Chapel Hill, I'm Jessica Coates.
One of the biggest historic controversies on campus concerns landmarks. UNC leaders are hoping some plaques and exhibits will help. They unveiled a plan at this week's Board of Trustees meeting to hang a plaque on Carolina Hall, a building formerly named after Ku Klux Klan leader William Saunders, and are looking at possible historic markers and other exhibits on McCorkle Place, where Silent Sam is. Chancellor Carol Folt said that administration is striving to meet requests and work with students.
These are issues that we care about and we think about all the time. Last year we began that whole series of Carolina conversations. Many people in this room and really many people in many different offices have been coming together to try to increase the capacity we have to work with students.
Other than the plaque for Carolina Hall, nothing has been decided yet. Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs and Task Force Co-Chair Winston Crisp said that possible plans include blue tiles on the brick walkways as historical markers, a UNC history museum, and orientations for new students to learn about UNC's full history. Crisp says that it's going to take a long time, but says people should be patient.
I am satisfied with the progress. Perspective is important here, right? You don't move from the resolutions that the board had to immediately putting up monuments and plaques and things like that. There is a lengthy period of time and a lot of work.
One thing that won't happen anytime soon is the removal of Silent Sam, because the state legislature recently put the monument on a protected list. The North Carolina Historical Commission, a group of 11 appointed by the governor, has the power to decide what monuments stay on the list. The Real Silent Sam Coalition, a group of students and faculty who have been dedicated to race and social justice causes, repeated their call this week for the monument to come down and Carolina Hall to be renamed again for Zora Neale Hurston, the first Black student to take classes at UNC before integration. Student reactions are mixed about Silent Sam staying and the progress that the task force is making. UNC junior Jessica Barnes is not wholly satisfied.
I think that they're trying hard to look like they're trying hard to fix things. I don't think that a lot is actually getting done, but I think that they are aware that people have strong opinions about these things, so they're trying to address that.
Senior Tess Boyle wants to see the monument come down.
Ideally, I don't think that something that stands for hate and discrimination should be on a college campus, especially a public college campus.
Senior Nick Berman says that Silent Sam should stay as long as its historical context is clear.
I know that a large group of people have a problem with it, but I think that if there was maybe a plaque put next to the statue explaining the history, it would be beneficial to everyone. I think that it's an important place for students to learn about the history of North Carolina.
The task force members are planning to hold a series of public meetings after they establish advisory boards.
Just over a week ago, the world was shocked by terrorist attacks in Paris. About 130 people were killed and more than 300 were injured. ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attacks. France and other countries have responded with military action, but the questions remain. What is the root of this problem and how can it be resolved? UNC Professor of History and International Affairs, Klaus Laures, joins us now. Professor Laures, thanks for being here.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, the events in Paris that transpired last Friday, a tragedy, that goes without saying, but we saw something interesting from around the world, a reaction by everyone. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, everyone's reaction was, of course, that everyone was very shocked, that everyone thought the events were absolutely dreadful, totally unexpected. And I think there was a lot of feelings for the French people. Everyone wanted to be French. It reminded us really of the time, the days and weeks after 9/11, when everyone said, we are all American now. So for a few days last week, we were all French.
Going forward, how are other Western countries, how are they going to be interacting with each other?
Well, I would predict that at least some sort of realignment between, above all, Russia and France can be seen. Probably also Britain and the United States will come in, at least to some extent, later on. So there probably will be a more cooperative front against ISIS in Syria. We still have to ask ourselves whether just bombing ISIS targets in Syria and Iraq, whether that really is the solution and will really end that war we seem to be at. And that is a question which leaders are at the moment asking themselves. It probably will need to be necessary to leave President Assad of Syria in power. We all know that he is a ruthless dictator, has plenty of blood on his hand, makes the life of the Syrian people a misery. But for the sake of bringing at least ISIS under control, we probably have to do that.
It's a situation of what's good in the long run. Absolutely. Versus reacting right now.
Absolutely. I think we need to think strategic now.
Should there be any fear by Western countries moving forward over the next few months that something like what happened in Paris could happen in the United States, in England, in any of those other countries?
Absolutely. I mean, how do you defend against guerrilla fighters, insurgents, fighters who are prepared to die and blow themselves up by also taking hundreds of people with them? It's very difficult to defend against that. You can have checks and controls, and that is what we are doing, what we are seeing now. But there are hundreds of thousands of people in each major city. How do you prevent really often just one lonely bomber who wants to blow himself up, taking dozens, taking hundreds with him or her? That is extremely difficult.
So then how do we go about regulating, you know, the refugees who are coming in, making sure that they are, you know, safe and are just genuinely looking for asylum versus those who could be trying to cause a problem? It sounds like it's a very, very, very low percentage, but still that's a genuine concern that a lot of people have about the Syrian refugees.
What really needs to be said is that now the House of Representatives seems to have voted for stopping all Syrian refugees coming into the country. This is, I think, a very surprising development. After all, 9/11 started the turmoil in the Middle East. That invasion of Iraq, which was, of course, as we know, not necessary. Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11, but it caused the beginning of the current turmoil in the Middle East. It led to the rise of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria, which we now call ISIS. And So the United States has a huge responsibility for the turmoil having developed there, including the refugee crisis. If you make a mistake, and many American politicians now see it as a huge mistake, you really still have responsibility for the mistake made, even if it was a mistake you didn't want to make, which happened unintentionally, and so on and so on. You still bear responsibility.
Professor Klaus Lares, once again, thank you so much for being here.
No, thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
You're listening to Carolina Connection, a UNC student-produced newscast. I'm Luis Fernandez.
And I'm Sarah Thomas. Giant cypress trees over 2,000 years old, fish that swim back and forth between fresh and salt water, eagles flying in the distance, the Cape Fear River has it all, and someone's got to watch over it. Our Elise McLothan took a ride with the riverkeeper.
I'm looking up and down the waterfront now, and I'm seeing, you know, a sailboat that does charters down there. I'm seeing private boats. There's a marina a little bit farther upstream.
That's Kim Burdett, the Cape Fear River keeper. He's known this part of Wilmington his entire life. He even claims to have known the river before birth, drinking its water when he was in his mother's womb.
I grew up on the Cape Fear River. I was born and raised here, and, you know, as even a small child, you know, spent a lot of time on the river paddling with my family and fishing and camping and just kind of being a little bit of a river rat as far back as I can remember.
And his time on the river has been well spent. If something harms its 9,324 square mile basin, Burdett does his best to fight against it.
I try to be the voice of the river. So I try to speak because the river can't. I use science to do that. I use facts and I use the law.
The father of two almost has a third child in the river. Burdett spends his time advocating for it against corporations and factory farms that pollute the river. According to the Cape Fear River Watch, there are more factory farms in the Cape Fear River Basin than anywhere else on the entire planet. Duplin and Sampson are the number one and two hog-producing counties in the U.S. Burdett says these operations have catastrophic effects on the Cape Fear. As he talks about wildlife on the river,
and he holds his wings out, all the way out extended to dry.
He says not enough North Carolinians are aware that so much is at stake.
Another challenge is just, you know, reaching people on these issues and getting people to understand that their livelihoods, their lives, their quality of life depends on our water resources.
One way Burdett helps people understand this natural resource is by guiding them on it.
Now he's pulling up his boat.
Every month between March and November, the 41-year-old takes a group of 40 or 50 people on the Cape Fear River paddle series.
The paddle series that we do is really sneaky. It's a total underhanded way to get people to fall in love with the river. Like, they don't even know what's happening, right? It's like you just tell them that you're going to take them paddling, and then they get out there, and then all of a sudden they're like, holy cow, this place is awesome.
In the midst of the vast biodiversity of the Cape Fear River, Burdett's reasoning for wanting to protect this natural gem becomes all the more clear.
People need to stand up for their clean water and their clean air, and they need to do it themselves, and they need to demand that our elected officials and our regulatory agencies do that, because otherwise it's not going to get done.
Burdett may be the official riverkeeper, but he wants each of us, especially the one-third of North Carolinians who live within the watershed, to be advocates for it. In Wilmington, I'm Elise McLothan.
Chris Gruner joins us for sports. Chris, if UNC wins in Blacksburg today, they win the Coastal Division and secure their trip to the ACC Championship game. But it seems like some people don't respect them. What's up with that?
I'm not sure, Sarah. If the Heels had beaten South Carolina in the Charlotte opener this season, they'd be undefeated. But that South Carolina loss doesn't look so good anymore. The Gamecocks are 3-7, and chances are they won't even make a bowl game. The UNC football team is 9-1, number 17 in the college football playoff rankings, and ready to take on the Virginia Tech Hokies today. The teams play at Blacksburg in noon. You can listen to the game right here on 97.9 WCHL. The Tar Heels are looking for another win after beating Miami last week, 59-21. Defensive coordinator Gene Chizik says he didn't know the team's rank at practice on Wednesday, but he did know what weapons the Hokies were going to bring today. One is sophomore tight end Bucky Hodges, and Chizik says he's really versatile.
They can move him around and put him as a stationary tight end. They can flex him out and use him as a wide out. So he poses
team's problems because sometimes he's a true tight end, sometimes he's a wideout. He does them both equally well.
We'll see if the Tar Heels can slow him down. Hodges averages only 41 yards a game in total receiving yards, but this season he's got 27 receptions and 5 touchdowns. So not only does Chizik not know Carolina's rank, but apparently Coach Larry Fedora isn't too focused on it either.
Actually, my wife told me when I got in bed last night, you know, I was like, great.
That's the crazy thing, though. Everyone else is paying attention to the Tar Heels. Technically speaking, if Carolina wins out, including a win over number one Clemson in the ACC championship game, UNC could make the 4-team college playoff. And if things go well today, you might see Marquise Williams, Ryan Switzer, and all the players dancing in the end zone. But that's nothing compared to the actual dancing some groups on campus do. Daniel Wallace shows us some real stars at Carolina.
The Star Heels dance team is leaping towards its fall showcase. These 36 women are practicing their pirouettes and improving their pliés. Star Heels choreographer Hunter Davis says although the dancers practice, they don't have to make perfect.
And I hope that we can continue to push people slightly. So we don't push people too much out of their comfort zones, but I hope that we can continue to push people to try to do their own personal best. And I think that being able to perform is really important.
The Star Heels certainly have an extensive skill set. From modern to jazz to even ballet, the ladies put in long hours to hone their talents. The hours of work not only build muscle, but more importantly, build strong friendships.
It's defined like my work ethic and body, because I hurt all the time. And I don't know, it's given me some of the best friends I'll ever have, so.
The dancers rave about the group's family aspect and say the support system is what really matters to them.
The team means family, people to talk to when everything else is wrong in college and you're away from your real family. It means a support system that you can always fall back on.
This dance family is ready to show us its strengths on and off the dance floor. In Chapel Hill, I'm Danielle Wallace reporting.
Basketball season is now in full swing, and the men's team is off to an undefeated start at 3-0. Kennedy Meeks has lost 50 pounds since he's been at UNC, and he's been killing it. He's averaging a double-double right now with 16.3 points and 10.3 rebounds. The team had to travel early Friday because Cedar Falls, Iowa, already has 10 inches of snow. The Tar Heels play Northern Iowa today at 2. And that does it for sports. Back to you, Lewis.
Chris Gruner, live with sports. Thanks, Chris. A website has ranked Carrboro, yeah, that's right, our Carrboro, as the best city for singles in the country. The site is called livability.com, and it helps people decide where to move. So what makes this unique town attractive for people looking for attraction? Jessica Coates reports.
San Francisco, Boston, Denver. These are the cities that pop up when you Google best places for singles. But for Carrboro local Josh Smicker, the best place is right here in Carrboro at Tyler's Tap Room. Although Smicker's been married for 3 years, he says the town hasn't changed much since he was on the dating scene. And even though Carrboro is small and may not be as well known as Boston or Denver, he says the size is part of its appeal.
There really is sort of something for everyone, but it's small enough that you can run into people that you've seen before and have something to talk about.
Livability.com had similar thoughts when it published its article titled 10 Best Cities for Singles. It put Carrboro at the top of its list. Matt Carmichael is the editor of the website.
Once we looked at all of the great amenities of the town itself and all the great events that single people can go to, we thought it was a pretty great place to be young and single.
Carmichael says that Carrboro's position next to a college town helped to catapult it to the top of its list.
When you're in college, the college towns are possibly a little less affordable. And as people graduate and start moving into the next life phases, they want to get a little bit of separation from that, but they don't necessarily want to leave the area that they've been spending the last 4 years in.
Livability used metrics such as diversity and cost of living. But Carmichael said they also did some more fun research as well.
We looked at people who are going to art galleries and bars and nightclubs, people who are engaged in karaoke, people who are going to romance movies.
Back at Tyler's, Smicker says that he finds those criteria a little bit far-fetched.
But despite the silly metrics, I think there's a lot of truth to it. There is really a sort of wide range of things to do, everything from go out and watch sports to go to the punk show.
Or hang out on the lawn of Weaver Street Market, which is also a hub for dating activity. That's where Noam Schemmer, a Carrboro resident and UNC student, usually goes. She recalls one time when she saw two people meeting for the first time there.
I was sitting kind of outside, and I remember seeing this girl was sitting and reading some kind of book, and this guy came and sat next to her and was talking to her about the book, and it just seemed like something out of a movie.
Other places on the list included Athens, Georgia, and Ames, Iowa. Of the 10 cities listed, 7 of them were near colleges. In Chapel Hill, I'm Jessica Coates.
In case you were wondering, there are 5 more days until you get to stuff your face and tryptophan all the way to your couch. With the new tradition, Ram's Head Dining Hall brought the Thanksgiving experience to UNC students a little early. Anik Joseph reports.
If you walked into Ram's Dining Hall Thursday evening, you might have felt like you were home for the Thanksgiving holiday. It's part of a new event on campus called Ramsgiving that Carolina Dining Services hopes will become a tradition. UNC's executive chef Michael Geis takes a walk to the turkey station. A line of about 30 people have already formed.
Over here, we've got local turkeys, seasoned them up, made gravy from the bones. Too bad you can't smell on the radio, right?
But Carolina Dining Services general manager Scott Weir says Ramsgiving is more than just a meal. It's about the real meaning of Thanksgiving. As students showed up for dinner, they were greeted with local charitable organizations that help people in the community handle hardship.
The hope being that students will come in, talk to some of the organizations in the lobby on the way out, and sign up to possibly get involved on a volunteer basis.
Donate Toys for Tots!
Organizations like Meals on Wheels, the Red Cross, and Toys for Tots lined the lobby at Ram's Dining Hall. And after signing up to become a volunteer, you then claim your free t-shirt.
What size is this?
This is the medium.
Thank you.
Weir hopes that this new tradition will help instill the importance of giving back.
What we're doing at UNC is trying to create global citizens, folks that, you know, see outside themselves and figure this might be an opportunity for folks to do that while they're right here on campus.
And right here on campus is where some people are having the challenges that we're talked about.
A lot of our employees actually have some challenges of their own. So, you know, our ability to directly give back, I think, is something we're very proud of. It warms your heart, that's for sure.
UNC student Shade Wilson, who joined a group of her friends at Ramsgiving, says she appreciated being introduced to organizations she normally wouldn't have been exposed to.
Because I wasn't aware a lot of those organizations or those clubs that I could sign up for and volunteer for until they had it presented there for Ramsgiving. So it's like a nice way to give back. It's all in the Thanksgiving spirit.
Still, for Wilson, Ramsgiving wasn't all about the giving. She was thankful for the food, too.
It reminds me of home. There was ham. There was macaroni and cheese, which I loved. Ugh.
In Chapel Hill, I'm Anik Joseph.
I am too excited for Thanksgiving. You got food, football, family, string quartets. Okay, maybe not that last one, but if it's a nice fall day on campus, you might just see some first years embracing their inner yo-yo ma.
Hi, I'm Andrew Michi. I play the viola.
Maggie Horzempa. I play the cello.
I'm Philip Riddick. I play violin.
I'm Svetok Sindar. I play the violin. We're part of a quartet, actually, so we meet once a week. And since it was a really nice today, we just decided to play outside.
Fall with the leaves falling, it just gives a lot of musical inspiration.
It's just another way to express yourself and get to decompress.
Like you could walk up and see people just on their phones recording, and then you heard the really beautiful music, and it seemed out of the ordinary, but also I guess not out of the ordinary because it's UNC.
So Sarah Thomas, what are you doing for Thanksgiving?
I think I'm going to head down to Wilmington and try to catch the flotilla, where people decorate boats for the holidays and parade them down the waterway.
Wow, that sounds really cool. I'm not doing nearly anything as exciting. I'm probably going to eat some food and pass out on my couch. And for this week, that's Carolina Connection, a production of the UNC School of Media and Journalism. Thank you to our production director, Tim Moran. I'm Luis Fernandez.
And I'm Sarah Thomas. Liked what you heard today? Well, you can hear current stories and past shows on our website, carolinaconnection.org. Have a great weekend, and as always,
go Heels!